It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I'm Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
Holy snowballs, Batman! It is Jeffrey in Los Angeles, and we got snow on the local mountains. That's how bad it got. This is like, what?
That's because there's no room for any more snow here on the eastern seaboard. We had to send it someplace else.
The snow bunny has had to deliver in other houses other than yours?
Yes, exactly. The snow bunny has been more than generous.
Now, see, now I'm going to have to go outside tomorrow and like drive a couple streets over and take a look at some of the mountains on the eastern rim of the valley and see if we got snow on the four peaks up there.
There you go. Huh? You'll have to take a peek at the peaks.
Yep.
That's terrible. But don't go beyond the rim. It's really hard to come back, trust me.
I know, man. You get stuck in Globe and all sorts of crazy stuff happens.
It's a frigid 65 degrees here right now.
Mm-hmm.
I know.
We're sitting right at about freezing.
And we're somewhere in the middle in the 50s, so.
Uh-huh. There you go.
Oh.
All right, so I went.
Okay.
You went there.
What's going on? What's going on? Look at Menengay. Look, I can see the top of his head. This is adorable. I love this. I love this. It's like you look like a speed bump.
Oh.
A speed bump. Okay.
You do.
I'm a hairy speed bump.
Well, there's this giant you know in the Ustream feed here. It's all studio with nobody in it. Ooh, that's exciting! And then there's this little speed bump at the bottom. Oh, it's very funny.
Yeah, that's all right. I'll be moving over to the other spot when you guys start geeking.
Cool. Yeah, today is Feedbackapalooza Day. We have a lot of voicemail.
Oh, that's right. Dude, I guess I won't be sitting in the background, will I?
Anywhere.
Yep.
We'll just call you Speedy for this episode.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so we'll tell you what. Why don't we just go ahead and take a quick break so we can jump into it, because it's a lot to plow through.
Wait. You know, no what? Hello NASA, nothing, none of that? We're not doing any
well,
intro?
You know what? We should. You're right. I'm sorry. Endeavor did dock this morning with the...
You know, here's what happened, Summer, is Tim finally prepared this episode. You know, after 200 damn episodes of this show, he finally is like, oh, I'm going to pre-produce one. And now he's all hot and bothered, ready to go. And he, like, left nothing to the ad lib, which is an integral part of the show.
The reason it's an integral part of the show is because we never do any prep.
That's called filling the gap. Very funny. All right. So, the shuttle took off. That's good.
Yes. And I docked with the International Space Station.
Today, right? It docked,
this morning. Mm-hmm.
And when is it scheduled to return to Earth?
I don't recall. They've got installation of the last module. Tranquility is being installed along with a cupola. And cupola? It's pretty full up there now. What with
cupola. A cupola. A cupola is like an Italian dish, I think, or maybe he was a famous director.
Yeah, a cupola, right? Ford Coppola, yeah.
Right. it's like an observation dome. It's ob-dome,
yeah,
dude.
It is.
Yeah, hello.
Exactly. And so pretty soon at the ISS, we'll have our own very own Susan Ivanova up there directing traffic.
Oh, very funny. Winchy pretty sweet.
Is always right.
Yep.
You will listen to Ivanova. Ivanova is God.
Mm-hmm.
Just kidding about the God part.
Okay. And then there was one other thing. We have a deal working we have a deal working. We'll let them know that that there's a possibility. We may. Oh, sorry, I knocked over my little Kashi here. We have a deal working, right? That we may have a Babylon podcast field reporter at the next shuttle launch. Correct.
That's what we're hoping for.
That's what we're working, folks.
You're kind of working that angle, yes?
Yes. He's going anyway. I don't know what we can get him to take photos of. And
No. You can't say it like that, Summer. You got to say, yes, we're sending our field reporter out there, and they're going to come back with great stuff for us.
Well, here's the problem.
Summer's right too honest.
Right there on the Kennedy website, it says, press passes don't count on launch days. Nanny boop. Yeah.
Right. And you said that.
So, he could flash his press pass and they'll just look at him like, sir, back to the end of the line. Back to the end of the line, sir. Now, don't make me have these Marines point M16s at you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Take you and your podcast and go back to Orlando. You can see it from there.
Well, I think you're really underestimating our field reporter's talents. I mean, he should be able. He doesn't need to be in the building. He can do some reporting out in front.
Exactly. Yeah,
actually,
there's a lot of angles.
We could put him in the Farpoint jet and have him fly over the launch pad right at the moment of ignition.
That'll happen.
If we can keep Mike from drinking the jet fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Well. It does run on scotch, so you know.
Speedy bump there.
I'm being told that tickets for launch go on sale tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. Mountain Time.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
All right, we better grab our Tauntaun sleeping bags and camp out.
All right.
There you go.
Well, Brett's begging to get in, so we need to.
All right, well, let's take a break.
We need to get Brett in the conversation here.
All right. All righty. Do that. Take a break.
I'm Tim. I'm a carologist.
And I'm Michael, and I'm a carologist.
And I'm Jeffrey, and we are carologists.
Yes.
And you are too. Okay, let's get right to it.
Toyota hybrid.
Toyota.
The Toyota Camry hybrid. And loved that car.
That
was
wonderful.
So freaking smart. It was smarter than me.
You take it off road?
About once a year, I play in the sand with it.
Because
no.
It just seems that so many people have vehicles that have four-wheel drive and never use it. Don't even know how to turn it on or why. I really feel like Mazda has always kind of had their finger on the pulse, and yet they don't flaunt that.
Add your voice to the conversation at www.carology.tv.
And we're back with, I'm going to say, part one of Mondo Feedback of Palooza Mania.
Wow. Yeah, it's going to be pretty intense, people, so
buckle up.
That's a lot of vowels. Vowels.
Yes.
And wow.
And that's Brett. He's joined us now in the quagmire that we call
Brett once was lost, but now he's found.
So he is actually in the cave with the great machine broadcasting from there.
Yep.
Yes,
he's down there with Zathras.
Me and Zathras are hanging out with Drawl these days.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's just jump into it, Mike. Run that first message.
Oh, my. Here we go.
Hi, this is Rod in Nashville. Just calling one little brief thing about Wheel of Fire, which I think is an amazing little episode. But in your discussion of it, you guys didn't touch on one of the more amazing things to me about it, which is just how little science fiction there is in the episode. Outside of Lita's burgeoning, or shall we say in full flower, psychic abilities, there's really not any actual science fiction. There's no spaceships. I mean, there's very little special effects. It's all personal drama. We're coming to the end of this thing, and we're getting a look, once again, inside these people's psyches. We're wrapping some storylines up. We're pushing some characters in certain directions. We're having things come to a head in certain areas. And it's really all character drama, which is really an amazing thing when you think about how big a science fiction tale we've been told for 5 years at this point. I think that's really fantastic. It's nice to see this kind of thing. And it's very rarely done in science fiction outside of what was normally called in Star Trek the budget episodes. Maybe this is a budget episode for Babylon 5, but it plays very, very well, and it's almost a necessity to kind of move the story to where it needs to be for the final couple of shows. Thanks again, guys, and keep up the great work.
Thanks for the observation. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I thought Wheel of Fire was a Johnny Cash song.
It burns.
Oh,
but
yeah,
no,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Ring of Fire.
Oh, dang. I always get those confused.
Yeah. And I think he's talking about your hemorrhoids.
Oh.
Wow.
Hello, Babylon Podcast. This is Papa Beast from Sandy, Utah. I'm calling to assist you on your geeking about the fall of Centauri Prime. I'm surprised you didn't bring this up, but I've always thought that Londo burying himself and letting himself being taken over by the Keeper is his way of taking to the last part of Lady Morella's prophecy. I never figured out what the other parts of Morella's prophecy were about, but that his opportunities to turn from the dark side. But this one was, this was the last one, which was, you must, at the end, give yourself up unto that which you fear most, knowing that it will destroy you. Mm-hmm. Now, some people may say that that's the giving himself up to being strangled by Jakar, but I think that's more like this part. But, I'd like to hear you guys' opinion on it. Bye.
I always thought the eye that does not see was Jakar in that prophecy. Because Jakar was the one who lost his eye.
Right.
So I always figured Jakar was the eye that does not see, and I always figured that, that which you most fear, which knowing will destroy you, was taking the Keeper. I don't remember what the other prophecy was. There was three of them, as I recall. What was the other one? Anybody remember?
I don't right off the top of my head. I'm embarrassed to say.
You must not kill the one who is already dead.
That's right, which was Sheridan.
Sheridan, right.
Something with the eye that does not see, and at the very last, if you've failed all of those, you must give yourself up to that which you does it fear the most.
Yes.
I think so.
And that would be trying to keep your daughter off the pole.
Ouch!
I can see where this thing is going, guys.
Hi guys, it's Edmund from Greenville. I need to disagree most strongly with characterizing Londo's acceptance of the Keeper as his last act of free will. Londo's tragedy is being trapped by his visions and prophecies. He accepts the Keeper precisely because he doesn't think he has any free will. He's just accepting his fated role. One of B5's strongest themes is the individual's ability to stand up and make a difference. I think Londo's arc is the counterexample of what happens if you don't make that stand. As Veer's actions in the Centauri trilogy show, the Drak can be opposed, resistance can be mounted. Londo could have stood up to them, said the Centauri will never knuckle under to their tyranny, and led the resistance himself. Instead, he remained hostage to his visions, to his perceived fate. Lady Morella said he had three chances to avoid her vision. Was accepting the Keeper the third one? Be seeing you.
Well, Edmund, I think we've just generally agreed that, yes, the Keeper is the third one. But I would also point out that I don't think that Londo would have been in a position, all things being equal, he would not have been in a position to mount the resistance, because he is the nominal head of Centauri Prime. If he refused, he probably would have been murdered on the spot.
I'd agree. I totally agree with that.
I thought his third chance was actually surrendering to let Jakar kill him so that he could let Sheridan and Delenn escape. I mean, that was the vision that he was always afraid of, watching, you know, dying with Jakar's hands around his throat.
I don't know that he was ever really afraid of that, because as I recall, somewhere in one episode, they say they dream about how they're going to die, like, long before it happens.
Right, he says that in Midnight on the Firing Line. That's the very first episode. The thing is, in that third season where we meet Lady Morella, and then a little bit later with War Without End, we see that when Jakar strangles Londo, Londo's attitude is more of resignation and
surrender.
Surrender, right, exactly.
Yeah, I think at that point, I recall, he says, you know, let's get this done. And he's giving himself up. He is not struggling at all. It's the Keeper that forces him to struggle with Jakar at the end. I think that Londo was quite ready to accept his fate at that point.
Right. So back to Edmund's point, you could say that, you know, it was not an act of free will. But I don't know that it was necessarily. I get the sense from what Edmund's comment is that Londo basically stopped trying to affect the world around him because he simply accepted that his prophecy determined a particular fate, and I don't think that's the case. I think Londo actively tried to make changes where he could. The problem with Londo is that. He was trying to do the right thing for the wrong reasons, and in the end, he ends up doing the wrong thing for the right reasons. If you catch the difference, you know, as he says at one point there in the last couple episodes, like I find that I have all the power in the world and I can't do anything.
That's right. Sorry, I do remember.
You know, but that was less a matter of resignation and more just like he just basically drove himself down into a dead end.
But see, I still see his choice to defy the Keepers because they wanted Sheridan and Delenn dead, and he said, "No, I'm not going to kill them." He defied them, knowing full well that it would cost him his life in one way or another.
And that was his last act of independence.
Yes, that's what I believe.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Bobcasters, it's Gary, and I'm listening to all this talk about running out of material, show ending, uncertain date, and I just want to reassure you that as long as this show is on, you will always have voicemail to answer to. I do not want this to be a concern or a worry in any way over the course of this year. If you put out shows, and occasionally even if you don't, you will still have voicemail to address, so do not worry. Relax, and there will be something to talk about always. Take care.
Wow. You know,
I like the way he phrased that. I don't know if that was a promise
or a threat.
The way he phrased that was, you're going to have something to talk about. Like, we'll call you. You may not like what you hear, but we'll call
you. That's what it sounded like. It sounded like, if you guys end the show, we will find people to replace you as show hosts and continue it.
Yeah, exactly. Trust me, there's weapons of mass destructions out there.
There you go.
Hey, Babcasters, it's Arkel, recovering from a chest cold, but regarding what Jeffrey was talking about in the deep geeking for Wheel of Fire, he mentioned how he should have felt surprised, you know, when Sheridan came up behind Lita with the PPG and everything. Yeah, I don't think that was actually the result of bad telegraphing, because that scene was actually in the trailer for the episode, so I think that's why it wasn't a surprise to anybody. Because, I mean, it's right there in the trailer. You see the PPG coming out, and then you see Sheridan saying, you're not the only one who's been touched by the Vorlons, and all that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Suzanne Plachette.
The Vorlons, okay. They give bad touch.
Very funny.
Hi, this is Colin from Fort Worth. I just want to call in response to your recent episode about the fall of Centauri Prime. A lot of things you guys said I agree with on that, especially the 900-foot Londo issue. I did think about it one way that you guys didn't bring up. Going back to what Elric said early on in the show, the great hand reaching out of the stars and the voices of his victims screaming. In a way, you can't see any stars in the background, of course, but Londo does raise his hands many points in time, and it stands to reason that as people are looking up into the sky at their new leader calling for unification, they probably would be screaming or yelling or at least making some kind of a noise. Yeah, just something to think about.
Yep, might have been a noise of, here we go again.
I don't understand though. What's he talking about? That Londo had his hand up, or that his people had that other Centauri?
Yeah, that's the question I was wondering. Like, yeah, I remember Londo had his hands up, but what?
When he was looking in the sky and stuff, but right?
I thought he was talking about the 900-foot Londo. That's telling his people, telling his people, hey, you know, we'll recover from this and become stronger or something like that.
Right, he was.
It was literal. Okay. I think it was more. Londo's actions had repercussions and ramifications that literally caused the death of billions across the galaxy.
Well, I think what he's pointing out is something that we've noticed throughout the series. It may not be necessarily a one-to-one correlation, but there are a number of echoes that ripple through the show. Yes, that was metaphorical. You know, Elric's, I see a great hand reaching out from the stars.
Great line.
It is. It's a fantastic line. And yeah, there's a certain resonance there with the 900-foot Londo.
Mm-hmm.
I never put those two together.
No, you know, it's funny. I never did either, but that's a darn good point.
Yeah.
Hey, Bobcasters. It's Gary, and I'm listening to the Geeking on Wheel of Fire, and you brought up the point about Sheridan and coming up to Lita. Jeffrey mentioned how it was sort of anticlimactic. And I'm just curious, you know, that one little scene really just seems to open up my imagination on what about being touched by a Vorlon prevents Sheridan from being controlled by a telepath at all. And, it makes me wonder not only about that, but about the whole scene earlier in the season with Bester. And could Bester not read him or control him in any way either? It's just a little tease of a line, but gosh, it just really makes me think. I'd love to hear Summers and Tim's, of course, opinion on the matter. Take care, guys. Bye.
Well, I think we should ask the Vorlon.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that all of these answers, Gary, would have been unfolded in season 6.
What's interesting is I didn't look at this anticlimactic, honestly. What I liked about it, because I was so into watching Lita do what Lita was doing, that I was just totally enthralled by that. But the question really is that he asked was would Bester have been able to do anything about it? I mean, I don't know, but I kind of took it that there was something different about being touched by a Vorlon in some form or fashion, as versus just being touched by Bester the telepath.
Oh, if I had a nickel for every time a woman has said that to me.
The difference is that Lita was exhibiting direct control over a group of minds, whereas Bester would simply be basically poking around and looking through the drawers.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. And I will say, I'm going to say that Sheridan wasn't just touched by Vorlon. I mean, that was the line in the show, but I mean, he was inhabited by a piece of a Vorlon for like over a year. That's more than I think just your average touching.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what it meant. He was changed by having a Vorlon inside of him for that period of time. Lita also carried the Vorlon inside of her for, you know, a period of time. So I'm thinking that changed their physiology somewhat.
Exactly. And obviously, you saw that definitely with Lita. I mean, she had gills for love of God. you know, which normally I have to pay extra for in Vegas, I'm going to tell you.
thank you.
Thank you very much. Tip your waitress. But yeah, I would say that was probably a physiological change of some form or fashion. I mean, never mind the magic pixie dust that you know, Sheridan was floating around with because of Lorianne. I mean, he was a walking medical mystery. I mean, let's face it.
Yeah.
Oh my God, the chat room is really, really taking the touch by a Vorlon thing way down left center field.
I'm already there. This season on ABC, a very special Touched by a Vorlon.
I was going someplace else with that whole thing, which again would require me being in Las Vegas. But
we now have a request for someone to come up with Babylon 5 parody lyrics for Touch Me from Rocky Horror.
All right, let's move on.
Go for it.
Moving on.
Hello, everyone. This is Rod from Nashville, or Rod in Nashville, more like. Calling to talk about the Fall of Centauri Prime and the episode previous to it. In a lot of ways, I remember when you were talking about the episode, you guys were talking about the episode right before Fall of Centauri Prime. You were talking about how slightly disjointed it felt, how maybe a different edit of the episode would have made it flow better. But the whole time I was listening to you talk about that episode, I thought, well, don't y'all realize that really it's part one. Fall of Centauri Prime Part 2. As a matter of fact, I've felt for a long time that both these episodes should have been called The Fall of Centauri Prime Parts 1 and 2 because they're very obviously Parts 1 and 2 of a single story, as is evidenced by the intro recap at the beginning of the second episode. That's my proof there. I just think that maybe JMS had a really good title for Part 1 and wanted to use that title. He's reused... titles that he didn't get to use before, The Long Night of Londa Mollari being one example. And I think that really it should have just been parts one and two of The Fall of Centauri Prime because that is the primary thrust of the entire story of these two episodes.
Well, you know, I would disagree in that there were a number of different things going on in Movement of Fire and Shadows. That culminates in Fall of Centauri Prime. So I don't know that it – I mean, I understand, Rod, what you're saying about it being, in essence, a two-parter, but no, I don't think so because then at that point you can go back through the entire series. And
yeah, it's an arc. So it's like
two or three – right, it's part of the arc. I understand I was reading on in Lurker's Guide the recap – that they had in Fall of Centauri Prime in one of those many weird B5 coincidences that went on with that show. Straczynski had written that ahead of time, and then it turns out those two episodes, Movement and Fall, were separated by like the NBA playoffs. Mm-hmm. And so TNT came to him and says, well, can you do a recap? And he says, I already wrote one. And apparently it was just kind of one of those freaky little things that had happened.
Hello, everyone. This is Rod from Nashville. When the Drock threatened to blow up bombs, he wasn't just around the capital city. The impression I got, and maybe I need to go back and rewatch the episode, but the impression I got was there were bombs all over the entire planet. And so that puts Londo's reaction, his immediate reaction of horror, in a much more obvious and clear context. So when you're talking about wiping out hundreds of millions of people all over the planet, as opposed to just wiping out the capital, not that that was a big concern. But anyway, I'm really surprised I managed to get in between the calls from Gary, but I'm really glad I did. keep up the good work, guys. You're doing great stuff, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks, Rod. I meant to go back to watch that scene again, and I didn't. I think the situation, though, is different. When Londo blows up the island where the Shadows have their ships housed, he's basically striking at a particular location. And although it pains him to do it, the fact of the matter is that in his mind, Londo the Patriot is willing to sacrifice the lives of the Centauri people in that area in order to protect the Republic. The situation is different. The Drak is basically holding him hostage.
And now, crickets.
It just means I'm right. That's
no, I mean, I was trying to find something to disagree with him. Like, yeah, I'm totally with holding, you on that.
Holding him hostage or holding the planet hostage?
Holding the planet hostage to get Londo to accept the Keeper.
Okay. Now you're correct.
Okay.
Hey, Badcasters, this is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm listening to the gang Deep Geek on Wheel of Fire, and I'm listening to you talk about the whole Lockley Garibaldi intervention, whatever the heck it was. And I'm trying to juxtapose Claudia with Scoggin, and I guess, I mean, you realize she's not supposed to be an exact replacement, but obviously, of course, she is fulfilling Claudia's shoes. And I'm just trying to picture if the weight from Ivanova, I guess, with Byron's loss, if she could have been that character, if she would have had the weight that Scoggins seemed to pull across in the Lockley character with the talking about Garibaldi. I suppose the Ivanova character would have talked about her father and things like that, but having it actually impact herself, I think it came home a little bit deeper than it might have with Ivanova. Just like you said. Take care, guys. Bye.
Well, I think it's a given. I think that, you know, we knew so much about Susan to begin with. I don't think that an intervention with Garibaldi. Well, let me rephrase it. An intervention with Garibaldi would have taken a different form than what it took with Lockley. And I would agree with Gary. I think it was much more powerful that it was with Lockley, a character whom Garibaldi had been smashing heads with for most of that season.
And didn't know that well. Somebody who's, kind of a stranger to him.
Correct.
I mean, it's different. When, I mean, obviously, you're gonna expect your friends to come and sit there and sit you down and say, "Hey, what are you doing?" But when someone out of the blue, who you really doesn't like you, says, "Hey, I've noticed this, and you're screwing something up, pal," I mean, that's huge. I mean, that's much more impactful, I think.
Yeah, and it was very powerful when she, you know that scene in the lift where she reveals that, you know, she doesn't drink because of her father's drinking, and Garibaldi goes, "Gee, I didn't know." And she's like, "Of course you didn't know, you idiot."
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, your head was up your tuchus.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah,
well, nothing. It's a family show. Careful there.
Oh, sorry. I thought I was being familyized. Anyways, yeah.
And so we're gonna take a quick break right now. Let us all gather our thoughts again. Maybe let Mike and Jeffrey refill their podcasting fluid.
Oh, don't take me out of that group. I want in the group there for the podcasting fluid.
Brett's going to also refill his podcasting fluid, and okay, we're going to come right back.
I'm Michael R. Menengay.
I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Michael Stackpole.
And I'm Brian Brown.
Join us for an exciting romp through literature and books.
Romp? We're not romping.
We're supposed to be cool.
That's smooth. Right. Okay. It's the cool.
It's the sounds. Smoothing sounds.
The smoothing sounds.
I don't know, but romp just brings forth images of Michael in tights, and I'm so not going there.
Well, which Michael?
It doesn't matter. Neither one would be very good.
If you would like to join this thing that we do every week, it's called Dragon Page, cover to cover.
Take two. Welcome to Dragon Page, cover to cover, where the elite meet to discuss literature.
Okay, let's go back to the tights images.
Yeah.
Dragon Page, cover to cover, where you'll never know what you're going to get next. And we're back with round two of Feedbackapalooza Mania.
Wow. Ding.
Ding, wow. That was exciting.
Yeah.
So there's more.
There's more.
Hello, everyone. This is Rod from Nashville. Both of you seem to, or all three of you actually, seem to have been impressed with the scene where the Drock pulls the Keeper off of his chest to implant it on Londo. But the one aspect of that scene that I didn't like was that there needed to be a different sound, kind of slurpier or squishier sound when it detached, when it was detached, because the sound that's on the soundtrack sounds like the live sound right there on the set, and it sounds a little inorganic. As a matter of fact, it sounds a little like what the prop probably sounded like a couple of pieces of plasticized stuff being pulled apart. I think a little bit of sound design help would have been nice right there to give it a different kind of gloopier sound.
Gloopier.
Gloopier.
I'm sorry.
Gloopier. I'm going to use gloopier about 3 or 4 times tomorrow. I swear I will. That's an awesome word.
I'm just going to say ew.
Yeah.
Gloopier. Well, I think that's Rod's point. Jeffrey, let me ask you something. When you're on set and there's supposed to be sound effects,
here's what you need to know. Have you ever really tried to pick up a Keeper before? No. So.
No.
Okay. I'm telling you, that was the real sound of a real Keeper. We went far and wide to get one of those. They're not easy to come by, you know.
Ventura Boulevard.
I'm disagreeing with him because that sound is squee-making enough. You know, you're like, ugh. You kind of get that really tingle. It's like, ew. It just reminds me of slugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you, but the I'm sorry he was disappointed in the sound, but my guess is it was not the actual sound from on set, because there would have probably been next to no sound, and it would not have been microphoned. So I'm sure there was some sound design there, and perhaps, I don't know, maybe if you were watching it on a regular TV with a little 1-inch speaker on the side, it didn't come through as, you know, it might have if you were in a full 5.1 surround sound environment.
It might have been gloopier.
It might have been gloopier. I know I'm feeling a little gloopier, but this show always does that to me.
Hey, Badcasters, it's Gary, and I'm listening to you guys geek on the Fall of Centauri Prime. Specifically, you're talking about the Londo Jakar and scene with Londo saying things can't be the same anymore. And you're talking about Jakar understanding this. This is exactly the choice that Jakar chose not to take. He chose not to be leader of his people. He felt that it wasn't a good thing for his people. For some reason, and it's never stated, I guess Jakar understands that Londo needs to be the leader for his people, or maybe not for that Londo needs to be the leader for his people, but Londo needs himself to be the leader of his people, and he understands that. So it's interesting that while Jakar actually rejects the whole notion of being the leader, he understands that Londo needs to accept it, and he's all right with that. He's not trying to talk him out of it the way that he himself talked himself out of being the leader, and he's accepting what his friend's choices are. It reminds me of Sheridan's speech in a few episodes where he talks about people change, and you have to remember them for what they are and appreciate them for what they've become. And you can see those footprints right here now in Jakar's acceptance of Londo becoming leader. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Yeah, excellent point, Gary.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Badcasters, it's Gary, and I guess I do have to give Tim at least a little bit of this point. This is probably one of the last episodes where JMS can really throw stuff in, so to speak. As we start to really wind down into these last few episodes, there's not much more room to throw anything in as far as, you know, character or details that way. And this is the last dumping point to throw in whatever he wants to throw in. As we start to get towards the end, everything gets pretty locked in, you know, because we know where we're ending up with Sleeping in Light
And I always got the sense the last few were definitely written more together than most episodes, and they really link up just so tight that it's hard to throw anything else in without it really being glaring. So I will concede to Tim that probably a few things were thrown in, although not necessarily for bad reasons. I'll talk to you later, guys. Bye.
I think Gary is referring to my general reaction to Movement of Fire and Shadow.
And?
Which I didn't hear, by the way, because I don't know what you said then, so.
Just agree, please. I've been doing it for 200 episodes. Just go with it. Just say, yeah. You're so smart, Tim. Just roll with it, okay?
Genius, Tim, genius.
Perfect. Thank you.
Hello, Babylon Podcast. This is Father Beast from Sandy, Utah. It was just a thing about your discussion of the Wheel of Fire, and it got into that sidetrack about alcoholics, and they're often not portrayed very well. I thought Babylon 5 did a good job, because you had people like Garibaldi, who was an alcoholic, and like most alcoholics, when they're not drinking, they're like real control freaks. They want to be in control of their lives, down to the smallest detail. That follows, because most alcoholics have known that when they're not drinking, that's what they're like. And then you've got the very people, people who drink but aren't alcoholics, like Susan Ivanova, who used to go down and have a drink after getting off duty. There's nothing like that. She's not an alcoholic. She just had a drink. Now, I can understand, Straczynski's point of view, because my dad was also an alcoholic, and I don't drink at all. There's the thing of children of alcoholics will generally either become abstainers or, on the road to alcoholism themselves. It's almost never the moderate imbiber that you see in, say, Ivanova. But I thought the spectrum was shown fairly well. You had people who did drink and weren't consumed by it. And you had Garibaldi, and I think Garibaldi was the only real alcoholic on the show. So anyway, that's my comment.
Wow.
Wow. One of the things that has really, as over the years that we've been doing this podcast, there have been many instances where listeners have called in to share a personal experience that either refutes something that we've commented on or reinforces something that was on the show. And I think that's one of the reasons Babylon 5 resonates so well with people, is because there are those real moments where people can look at it and say, you know what, that's my experience. And I think that's a very rare show, certainly in a science fiction setting. So, Father Beast, thanks very much for that voicemail. It's appreciated.
Hi, guys. It's Edmund from Greenville. Here's my two cents on the Lita Garibaldi sequence. I've always thought she really was in his head, taking her Vorlon enhancements out for a test drive. The seed had already been planted by the whole Byron blackmail brouhaha, and who better to rummage around in than the Alliance's security chief? As for not detecting Garibaldi's drinking, come on, this man's a master of denial, so it's not going to be uppermost in his thoughts. I'm sure it would take a much deeper scan to have uncovered that. And by the way, it must be hell being an alcoholic in a place where the room is always spinning. Be seeing you.
Wow.
Nice. Very nice. Very nice.
Hello, this is Babylon Podcast. This is Father Beast from San Diego, Utah. One more thing. Somebody please tell me, where did the name Olkesh come from for the second Kosh? I don't remember them ever saying the words Olkesh on the TV show. The first time I heard it was while listening to the Babylon Podcast. Somebody tell me where that name came from. Please. Thank you.
Okay, you want to hear my theory?
Yes.
Do you remember the whole thing of, you know, well, what's your name? Well, my name's Kosh. Well, no, Kosh is dead. Well, no, your name is Kosh. Well, we are all Kosh.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what was being said. We are all Kosh. We're all Kosh. We're all, it was just sort of like a slang all- or a, it was, it was an accent maybe from Biloxi, I think is where it actually came.
I hear what you're saying. I hear
that's
what
all,
you're
man.
Saying.
That's all. We're all Kosh.
No, you know, it's one of those. The analogy that popped into my head was the character in Empire Strikes Back, Lando Calrissian's right hand man, Lobot. The only way you knew that is that was the character's name as if he bought the action figure.
There you go.
It's the same kind of deal. It was written down. It was in all the press releases.
That's right.
But you know,
I thought it was in one of the scripts or one of the novels.
No. Well, it might have been. Yeah, I mean, it's clearly in the scripts, but it was never a spoken word.
Right.
Exactly.
They only referred to the original Kosh's last name, if that's what it was. I remember them referring to that twice in the entire series. And I don't remember the second Kosh. I don't remember talking about his last name at all.
I think it was Smith.
Really? I could have sworn it was Jones, man. It was Jones.
No, Agent Smith.
I honestly don't remember where the first time I saw Neuronic was.
That was in The Gathering, I thought.
Was it on the screen?
No, it wasn't on the screen.
There was another port. There was a reporter who also said, "Hey, we're trying to get a look at Kosh, you know, the Vorlon Ambassador Kosh Neuronic." God, I don't remember what episode, but it was like literally there was only two times in the entire series they ever said his last name ish.
God, I'm gonna have to go back and really dig, because I don't recall ever hearing that one either.
Now I'm gonna while we're sitting here talking, I'm gonna have to go digging.
That's fine. That's good.
That's fine. Just don't type.
Yeah. next
voicemail. Here we go.
Hey, Babcasters. It's been a long break, but don't worry. I still got the Babcast on speed dial. And while I had a chance to, you know, just think about the Babylon Podcast, I couldn't help but look at the cover art. I'm not sure if you've ever heard this story, but now Jeffrey is obvious that he's the Vorlon in the drawings on the line coverage. Although I'm sort of curious why he didn't pick Centauri and why Summer not only picked, I guess, Earth Force, but pick the Army of Light uniform, or did she pick it, and was it just Tim choosing everything? I was just curious about why you two picked those two uniforms or costumes to wear on the line graphics for the art. Take care, guys. Bye.
We didn't get to pick that stuff, Gary. That was assigned to us by Warner Brothers.
I believe Tim identified with the Centauri because of the baldness. And I had mentioned somewhere along the line that if I ever, there were only two uniforms from the sci-fi genre that I would ever want to have owned. One was the original Battlestar Galactica Colonial Warriors uniform. And the other one was the Army of Light uniform. So Tim ran with that.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned that like on an old Slice of Sci-Fi.
That was a long time ago.
Bringing it, yeah, so.
Hi, Colin from Fort Worth again. Sorry to be a first-time caller, two-part voicemailer. Another thing I wanted to ask about that podcast you had about the Fall of Centauri Prime, you talk about the episode felt as though it could have been the end of the show. Now, I don't have all the script books as you guys seem to, but I have read in places that at one time the Babylon 5 story was meant to be a 10-year story, not a 5-year story, and that once the ratings came back and the executives started acting like asshats, Jay Andrzejewski and company had to find a way to compress 10 years of plot into 5 years of story,
and then 4 years of story. So I know that the Londo situation was supposed to be part of the original storyline. Do you think that maybe in the original plan, the fall of Centauri Prime could have been the end of the show? It does have that kind of climactic, blow up all your battleships, everyone abandon ship sci-fi tone that the 90s was kind of famous for. Any thoughts?
Well, first of all, let's clear up one thing. When we talked about the fall of Centauri Prime as feeling as though the series could have ended there, that was more an observation about the feeling we got from the episode. It wasn't necessarily a comment saying this was part of the plan for the show. You know, there was a finality to that episode that had the series ended at that point, it still would have been satisfactory. Mm-hmm. Regarding the 10-year plan, again, this is one of those I should have looked at before we did the episode. That was Straczynski's original plan, but he changed it to a 5-year plan before he even sold the show because he knew that selling – I mean, it was hard enough to sell a 5-year plan to studio executives, never mind a 10-year plan.
Because wasn't the original idea for – the original series would end somewhere in the third season and then it would spin off to the second series, like a different series that would have its own separate arc. So we would have had maybe a total of between 5 and 7 years of story.
Something like that. Something mm-hmm. like that. And if I remember correctly, actually War Without End would have, or parts of War Without End would have been the series finale for Babylon 5.
Right.
Sinclair and Delenn would basically have hopped through time to commandeer Babylon 4, but keep it in current era, not back 1,000 years. And then the next 5 years was to be called Babylon Prime, in which Babylon 4 would have been used as the base to fight the current Shadow War.
But we do know that when he changed to the current 5-year arc, we knew that the last thing we would see would be Babylon 5 blowing up. I mean, he said that from early on.
Right, right, right. And again, just to reiterate, he never tried to sell it as a 10-year plan. That was like sitting down. This is, if I had no restraints, this is what I'd want to do. Okay, now what do I have to do to try to sell the damn thing? You know, and the first thing that went was making it a 10-year story. Mm-hmm. So,
hi guys, it's Edmund from Greenville. I'm so glad you're back from your halls. I especially wanted to thank Tim for his hard work in the interim putting together the Year in Review episode, because he reminded me of something I'd forgotten to call in about. This was the year we finally discovered that Jeffrey landed Kosh because he was the only one who was enough of a pinhead for the job.
Ow!
And that comment about Yarsto last week? Come on, guys. Yarsto got out of that closet a long time ago.
Wow.
Be seeing you.
Pinhead.
Pinhead, yeah.
Pinhead, how's that? Wow. Edmund, you know, I mean, deflated ego? Small-minded, any of those other phrases would have worked better than pinhead.
As they say, if the encounter suit fits, wear it.
That was more of a Cinderella moment, okay?
That's awesome.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello, this is Father Beast from Sandy, Utah. Listening to Tim and Summer geek on the classic Day of the Dead episode. I'm just going to kind of come right out with it. I think Tim's problem, you know, stems from something, you know, deeper than the fact is that, you know, I think Tim's problem, which he's, you know, repeated throughout the series, you know, he's had problems with the Technomages. I got to go back and listen to see if he had the same problem with the Soul Hunters way back when, is that he doesn't like that this B5 universe, the technologically advanced species are also tend to be deeply spiritual, which is a way contrast from the aggressively atheistic way of Star Trek. You know, in Star Trek, every time somebody worshipped a god,
or did magic or had a vision or something, there was a technological explanation for it. And in reality and in this version of science fiction, that's not always the case. It harks all the way back to Soul Hunter, where we're not only talking about the existence of souls and that Minbari, the superstitious people that they are, just take reincarnation as a matter of course. It's funny that these technologically advanced people would be clinging to some superstition like this, except for the fact that there's some relevance to it. And it's more than just giving meaning to their lives. There's actually something to it. I'm thinking that this grates on, because every time there's something that spiritual or magical, you know, anything like that, and I don't get your complaints, you know, I don't want any fantasy in my science fiction, since fantasy and science fiction are the same thing, it's just different names. So there I spelled it out. Tim, you may now delete my voicemail because you don't want to listen to it. Bye.
Wow.
Well, hey.
Okay. Where did that end up?
Okay, well, let's work backward on this one. First of all, just because you don't agree with me doesn't mean that I'm going to delete it because I don't want to hear it. So
okay, but wait. I love any voicemail that comes in that starts with, okay, well, Tim's problem is, I love that. I love that. Okay, that's like a whole nother podcast we need to do someday.
Yeah, Tim's problem is.
You mean after the Day of the Dead podcast spinoff?
There you go.
It's just going to be all discussions of Day of the Dead all the time.
From around the world calling in constantly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, I think maybe.
It's your work. All right. Well, first of all, we could do a whole podcast on how fantasy is indeed different than science fiction. Okay. Let me also make it clear that it's not that I object to the spirituality part of it. And spirituality is a different thing than magic. The spirituality that's reflected all through the series is a wonderful thing. And yes, I was brought up on original Star Trek where gods turned out to be Godzilla heads run by computers and deserved to get a phaser in the snout. Okay, fine. One of the refreshing things in Babylon 5 was that acceptance, the different ways in which the various cultures tried to make sense of the universe around them in terms of spiritual and religious beliefs. Having said that, and Soul Hunter was the episode that sold me on the series. I loved Midnight on the Firing Line, but Soul Hunter was like, wow, this is just, it's different than Star Trek. It's something completely new and different, and I loved it. The thing is, what I don't like is with Day of the Dead, they tried to use techno babble to explain the spiritual thing, which I think is just never works. It's a bad idea. It would be a bad idea in Star Trek, and I can give you a dozen examples in Star Trek where they do bad things like that. With the techno mages, I have run enough Dungeons and Dragons campaigns in my life to know when the dungeon master is bringing out his favorite character to run as an NPC to make him all powerful because he can. That's what the techno mages were to me in Geometry of Shadows. Now, having said that, I loved Jean Cavellis' techno mage trilogy because what she then does is recast the all-powerful techno mages and their abilities as a curse and a burden, which is not evident in Geometry of Shadows. They simply show up as all-powerful, all-knowing beings. Well, if they're all that, why are they leaving? Mm-hmm. So, there. Jeffrey, I included that one specifically because I know you get a charge out of it.
We don't have enough time for me to rebut any of that. I'm just going to write this down and smack you with it later.
I haven't had enough Jack Daniels. Sorry.
We'll have to. Maybe that's what next week's episode will be. We'll have the final throwdown on Day of the Dead.
Day of the Dead, Smackdown.
Somebody better send me another bottle of scotch then.
No, but seriously, Father Beast, don't be afraid to send in your disagreement. That's all good. It's all good.
Right.
as great as it is.
We haven't banned anybody from this show yet.
No, right. We've had people ban themselves. So, you know, hasn't been because of us. We welcome difference of opinion. That's how you get conversations started.
Mm-hmm. And wars.
Yeah, well, that too.
Absolutely.
Thank God Green. Jeffrey hasn't been able to raise an army yet.
Purple.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Green. Purple.
I'm green, yeah. Green.
Where do you, Brent, we haven't asked you that. Where do you fall on the political spectrum?
Green.
Okay, there we go.
So Jeffrey and I are the only purple ones, huh?
Well, in purple, you're stunning.
Of course.
In purple, I'm fabulous.
Wow.
Okay, can we please wrap this show up now? We're done.
Is that it?
That's all for the voicemails?
That's it. That's it. Okay. Let's go.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening. We got to go. We got to get it. So call it number nine. Bye.
Perfect. See you next week.
special calls in if you want to add your thoughts to the Day of the Dead SmackDown. Just say, open it up. What the hell?
I'm brushing my teeth. I gotta go to this meeting. Hurry up.
It's awesome.
That was great.
Come on, Summer. Get us out of here. Let's go. Come on.
I can if he's going to be brushing his teeth while I'm talking. Wait for him to finish. Just say, when you call into the voicemail,
I'm not sure
line,
that's a toothbrush, but hey, that's just me.
Just say, this is for the Day of the Dead SmackDown, and Tim will set it aside in a special folder. Email. I'm trying to get my head on straight.
She's all sideways tonight.
You have no idea. Email babylonpodcast@gmail.com, forums, farpointforums.com, phone number 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Here, Jeffrey brushed his teeth for us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the Day of the Dead SmackDown.
Which I'm going to win.
Not.
Three.